Hi, this is Arnie Harnison, and this is The Attitude. It is our Monday edition, also known as Rethink the Week. I want to remind everyone that we Zoom our show on Sunday afternoon. So if something should happen Sunday night, my fabulous panel of guests will not be discussing it. As you come to expect, we begin every show with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman when he testified before the impeachment hearings of 2019. At that point in time, and after he and his brother were escorted out of the White House, I wanted to make sure that you heard his words and his powerful testimony in your ears as you walked into the voting booth, or you voted by mail, or you voted absentee, or however you vote in November, in your head as you exercise the franchise. And since then, I could play so much that I want you to hold on to before this election. But let's hear the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
If it's our Monday show, it's our Rethink the Week. And we bring together a fabulous group of guys to talk. It's usually a sort of a transitioning group. And just like everything else, this one is going to be interesting and yet somewhat different. Our regular talker is Dean Spiliotis. He is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. You hear him on New Hampshire Public Radio for their sort of end of the week rethink. And he has a blog that's entitled nhpoliticalcapital.com. Before I go to my next two guests, I mentioned that you teach at Southern New Hampshire University, Dean. And just before we started recording the show, you said, I said, well, like, let's talk about what your future is like. And you said, I'll be sitting in this chair right now, the way I am with you via Zoom for the next 6 months. So tell me what the decision has been at Southern New Hampshire University, because it sounds like one, it's an early decision, and one that has not been made by many other institutions.
Yeah, a lot of schools have been announcing their decisions for the fall over the last week. And so just this past week, SNHU announced, it's actually going a little bit against the trend. The trend seems to be most institutions are making some attempt to have some in-person instruction on campus, while at the same time also making arrangements for people who, for either health reasons or other reasons, want to stay off campus. So SNHU actually announced that they're going to be completely online at least through all of fall semester. But they are going to lower the tuition to be in line with the online program. One of the big debates in the spring was that a lot of schools, when they had to suddenly go online because of the COVID lockdown, the in-person instruction continued on at the regular tuition rate, which is typically higher than an online course. So now, this time around, SNHU is bringing its tuition for all courses will be reduced to the online rate. So this is a part of a big discussion going on in academia. About this. Yeah, and Sunday night, 60 Minutes is doing a segment on the pros and cons of trying to bring students back onto campus. But, you know, for me, I now know I'm going to be sitting in my chair teaching online for another term.
Well, let me introduce Paul Peter Jessup. Paul Peter Jessup is an attorney. I have known him for years. He used to be very active with the Republican Party in Portsmouth. I'm not sure you're very active with the Republican Party anymore, Paul Peter, but I want to welcome you to the program. You're one of the most thoughtful people I know, and I'm really grateful that you're joining us again.
Well, thank you. It's always great to be here or be with you. And yes, former Republican, I would have described myself at one point as a Rockefeller Republican, but that wing of the party is long dead. And was hoping Bill Weld might pull a rabbit out of his hat, but that was going to be impossible. So I have left the Republican Party, and the party of Lincoln is no more.
And on that somber note, let me introduce Dave Leventhal. It's been a while since Dave Leventhal has joined our Rethink the Week. I have known Dave since he worked for the Lawrence Eagle Tribune when he was just a child. He has now traveled the country, provided fabulous journalism work in places like Texas. He has, up until I think this month, been a very key player at the Center for Public Integrity. But Dave Leventhal, why don't you tell people what your current job is and how long you've been doing that current job for the Center for Public Integrity, which has been an award-winning site. But you are about to leave and join another site that I use on a fairly regular basis. So one, welcome to the program, and talk a little bit about your sort of job shift.
Thank you, Arnie. And yes, after 7.5 years at the Center for Public Integrity, we're a national nonprofit investigative news organization here in the belly of the beast of Washington, D.C. I am making the jump from my home office to my home office and going and joining Business Insider. They've just opened, despite the pandemic, despite the economic malaise, a new Washington, D.C. bureau. And there's going to be 6 of us to start. We hope to add a few more as things go along this year. And I will start on June 29th. So keep your eyes out for what I hope are going to be some pretty solid quality articles about the nexus of power, policy, and politics.
Well, congratulations, mazel tov.
Thank you, Arnie.
There's so much to talk about. And I went to the American Prospect this morning, and Harold Meyerson, I used to write for the Washington Post. He's one of the executive editors at the Prospect. And I just wanted to share a couple of sentences that he wrote because we are living in such interesting times. I thought to some extent that I would be talking about Georgia today, but I thought I would be talking about elections in Georgia. And of course, it turns out that over this weekend, the conversation has changed. And now it's a conversation that feels more familiar to folks who are covering the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Minnesota. But I wanted to just read a couple of sentences from one of his more recent pieces, sort of comparing this time to what feels a little bit like the Civil War. And he wrote, "In the Prospect's pages, I've been comparing our condition to the Civil War for quite some time, finding similarities to the Confederacy and the Republicans' current war on Black voting. Noting the echoes of the antebellum South's drive to extend slavery into the free states and the spread of right to work laws from southern states to northern ones like Wisconsin, Michigan, Indiana, when they fell under Republican rule during the past decade, and equating the efforts of city and state governments under Democratic control to create sanctuaries where undocumented immigrants could be safe from ICE arrests to the efforts of northern cities to hinder the seizure of former slaves and free blacks by Southern slave hunters under the Fugitive Slave Act. Now, the video showing Minneapolis cops murdering George Floyd seems to have had a political effect somewhat akin to the South's unprompted attack on Fort Sumter, which enraged the North and propelled the nation into open civil war. What united the North was not only an immediate sense of outrage, but also a sense that by the nation's breaking apart, the very idea of a democracy would be threatened. Also uniting the North was a long simmering anger at the South's dominance of the federal government and its policies, a belief held even by many white Northerners not yet committed to emancipation. Today, rather than seeing the murder of George Floyd as some outrageous one-off, the vast majority of Americans see it as a continuation of a national pattern of racist and brutal policing." And then of course he goes on to talk about the fact that 69% of the public see the murder as part of a broader pattern, 74% support the protests, and just 10% blame the protesters for the violence. Oh my God. Paul Peter, I'm gonna start with you. I wasn't sure that we would survive as a nation after the election of Donald Trump. And then we got the pandemic, and the denial of science, and the doctors, and the desire to go back to work and not protect people and keep us safe. And then comes a video of 8 minutes and 46 seconds. And of course, there have been plenty of videos, there have been plenty of killings, but this one, at this time, with this president and this pandemic, has clearly lit a match. What are you observing or thinking as you see what is happening around the country, Paul Peter? How do we get our arms around it so it's not just banning a chokehold? As if somehow, I hear, you know, Governor Cuomo, you won, you won. No, they didn't. No one's won. It's not even possible to say that at this point in time. But that's sort of what the suggestion is. You know, I'll fire someone. I'll get rid of a chokehold. That's not winning.
I would say, like many, many people, I'm anxious. I'm still hopeful. I'm hopeful for this reason. If you look at the folks who are participating in the demonstrations, these were not just African Americans. These were a range of people from all backgrounds. I also noticed the number of young people who were involved. And I live in an upscale neighborhood or upscale county, and I remember driving and the road being blocked off by the sheriff, and there was a huge number of high school students. There were so many high school students, and of course, school is out, that were marching in protest. That was very telling to me. So for that reason, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful also for this reason. It underscores how delicate and fragile democracy is, and you better not take it for granted. I think there is a national lesson here. I also think that in the tragedy, we can learn and we can grow as a nation. I also think, and this is going to sound perhaps a little naive, let's get back to fundamentals. What exactly does it mean to be a republic? What exactly did Thomas Paine mean to be a republic? And I think there will be larger issues that have to be discussed. Right now, we're talking about the Black man's experience. Let's not forget the Black woman's experience. That's just the tip of the iceberg. And so I'm hopeful. And unfortunately, it took tragedy and it took a bizarre, tyrannical president. And we should never forget, he never received the popular vote. And if this is how we have to get there, then this is how we have to get there. Let's find the positive and let's be hopeful.
I think Donald Trump with the pandemic, Dave Leventhal, was this amazing sort of cocktail that was created. Donald Trump's overt racism, his perpetual lies, his desire to make everybody else expendable but himself, my Black supporter. Remember that time when he sort of, again, the language he used was the language of the slaveholder. As if he owned this guy. It's just kind of amazing. You take the pandemic, and then of course now it's now on tape. We now have the video, something that we didn't have 10 years ago, but now we have today. And I do think that people have been feeling unhappiness about the inequality, but now they're realizing that if I'm feeling unhappy about the inequality, imagine people making certain assumptions about me because of my color. And so on top of oppression and underemployment and lack of healthcare, I'm now a target as well. I mean, that's what the African-American experience is in America. It's all the things I'm angry about, but I don't walk around afraid because of my color. And what I think we're beginning to realize is that it isn't a one-off. There is something wrong with our sort of racist reactions, Dave Leventhal.
And we have a situation where here in DC and here all across the country, you have two questions of change. One is the short term, and we've seen in spades the many, many different ways that the events of the past couple of weeks have spurred short-term change. There have been public officials, as in some cases, very prominent positions, who have resigned. They've been fired. You have laws in cities or states that are changing or have already changed, dealing with policing, dealing with government operations. And then you have issues of even the ability for people to exercise the right to protest in the midst of a pandemic. I mean, we went from stay at home at almost all costs to hundreds of thousands of people marching in the street in cities across America. So the rapid change in the short term has been stark. One thing that's on my mind, Arnie, is the longer term change and what's going to happen not next week or even next month, but what's going to happen September, October, and November, and the degree to which this upheaval, this unrest, this anger, this outrage is going to translate at the ballot box. And the ballot box in and of itself is a pretty funky situation, as we saw very recently in the state of Georgia during their primaries there, in the state of South Carolina, in Ohio, in Wisconsin back a few weeks ago. So we have, you know, longer term, this outrage and this upheaval and the question of whether this is going to be poured in a major way to benefit Democrats, to benefit Joe Biden, to benefit the Senate. I mean, the Senate could be flipped. The House could be retained. The White House could be won for Democrats. And all of a sudden, we have a political landscape in this country come January that is as radically different then as it is today. But is that going to happen? And I'll just end this thought by saying, we have so many issues right now, Arnie, with the ability to vote, that could be, in at least some cases, a huge obstacle or a wet blanket in terms of people's ability to vote, number one, or their desire to vote if they don't trust that the system is going to be there for them to either vote remotely, to go to the polls and not have to stand in line for 7 hours. We got some major issues here that are going to have to be figured out between now and October, November.
So Dean, as I'm thinking about this, and I've been watching the protests, and I've been looking at what's happening, and I've been angry because I want mail-in balloting, because I want to protect people. But I'm going to tell you something right now, Dean. I've never felt like it was a life and death choice for me to vote, and I am prepared to take that life and death choice and risk getting sick. Rick, I think voting now has never been so important to me in my entire life. And if they're willing to risk, you know, marching, I get it. But I see that the only way I can translate that energy and that power is to do whatever it takes to show up and vote. And I I'm annoyed that we're probably not going to get, you know, mail-in balloting. I'm annoyed that we're not going to get, you know, early voting in New Hampshire. I'm annoyed that in Texas they say that, you know, fear of contracting COVID-19 is not a disability for the purposes of an absentee ballot, but in New Hampshire it is considered a disability for the purposes of an absentee ballot. So every state has got its own interpretation, but I think no matter what the interpretation is, I have interpreted the last couple of months not only seeing young people and old people and white people and black people, but I've seen that the exercise of voting is almost like enlisting during a war. I feel like I have to enlist. And if I am willing to enlist, I am willing to vote, and they will not stop me. That's how I translated this last couple of weeks, dude.
Yeah, well, Arnie, I think certainly a lot of people feel the way you do. There is a lot of concern about, on the one hand, whether or not there will be sufficient opportunity to vote mail-in if you have health concerns or other concerns. Part of the problem, as you mentioned, is that this is really determined at the state level, although the federal government can make it easier or harder depending on how they toy with funding and whether or not they file lawsuits and things like that. A lot of this is going to be litigated, I think, in advance, as quickly as possible in advance of the November election. Although, you know, for example, we have a primary coming up in September here in New Hampshire. Now, as you mentioned, in New Hampshire, you can use COVID as a reason to request a mail-in ballot. You know, so many states already have high percentages of early voting and mail-in ballots. But the other concern is for people like you or anyone else who wants to vote, you look at what we saw in Georgia. We've seen that before in other places like Arizona, where we saw Milwaukee during the primary, where, you know, it was 105 or 110 precincts reduced down to like a half dozen. And so voting should not be that kind of ordeal. Now, in a lot of communities, it's not. But in underserved communities, the same communities that are dealing with a lot of the racial unrest right now and inequity and disproportionate impact of COVID, you're now dealing with that issue as well, having to wait hours to vote. But I do think a lot of people feel the way you do. And I've had several people say to me, you know, if the crowds we're seeing on television protesting, a lot of whom who are young and don't typically vote in high numbers, if those folks all turn out, Donald Trump has a very, very, very narrow path to the presidency. If they don't, if the movement gets bogged down with internal divisions or lack of focus, then there may be a problem.
Or if people just feel complacent, having gotten out and marched a half dozen times November.
How can you get complacent after marching? I mean, no offense, but I think marching.
Well, I think the question is whether the young people are going to show up to vote. And
the fact that they march doesn't mean
they're going to vote.
Well, it depends on whether they see the marching as an end in itself or part of a larger strategy that involves voting.
Well, that's why I get angry when Governor Cuomo says you've won. I'm like, wash your mouth out with soap. They're not, this is not winning, honey bun. You know, I don't care. If you think that's going to make me complacent, it's like, I feel like there's a disconnect. So I want to talk about the sort of the big immediate issue of the moment. And, you know, Dave, you talked about the fact that there's the short term and then there's the long term. So there's the idea of defund the police. And one of the things that we've heard thematically on virtually all the shows and talking to everyone is that part of the problem is that we have expected the police to respond to everything. That they're supposed to be the mental health counselor. They're supposed to be the domestic violence counselor. They're supposed to be in the schools. They're supposed, I mean, so they don't have the skill set. They can't possibly be effective in responding because their answer to everything, they usually have it on their hip with their holster, or they have it with their badge, or they have it with their spray gun, or they have it with their taser. That's their answer. Last time I checked, that really doesn't help for mental health counseling. I don't tase my patients, you know what I mean? I don't want to go into a school and bring a gun into a school. But let me also say something else. I grew up in a very conservative family. I mean, wicked conservative. My parents had, you know, English only on the door. My father had pictures of Newt Gingrich on the wall. I mean, people cannot believe that I emerged from my mother's womb, all right? And so, but the one thing my dad taught me was something he referred to, and you hear it a lot with Republicans, about personal responsibility. Now, let me tell you what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is that whether it's the guy in Minneapolis who had told his employees that if you get a fake 20, you call the cops. And then after what happened to George Floyd, he went, I'm never gonna do that again. I'm taking that order back. I made a mistake. I should never have done it. And then let's go to Wendy's. And what happened was a guy's asleep in his car and the response is to call the cops. Now, Paul Peter, my dad said always to me, what's your job? What should you do first before you go to a cop, before you rat on the teacher, before, what's your job? Should you step up and exercise some sort of authority or responsibility in a situation? And I've told this story over and over again. There's a bus outside the front of my house because it's an elementary school. And the little like red and white light, red lights go on and the stop sign comes out on the bus, you know, and that means all the cars are supposed to stop. So guess what, Paul Peter? Cars go right by it like they don't stop. And you know there's gonna be little kids that are gonna be killed. So what does Arnie do? Did Arnie call the cops? No, she stood in the middle of the road. She put her arms out and I said, hit me, okay? Hit me. So here's what happened, Paul Peter. Someone called the cops on me. And when the cops came, they said, Arnie, you really shouldn't be doing this. And I said, really, arrest me. All right? That was my response. You know why I did that? Because if I had waited for a cop to show up, a kid could have been killed. And I knew they weren't going to run over me because I'm too big. And so part of what I saw happen at the Wendy's and part of what I saw happen in Minneapolis is we have now not taken over some authority over our places of employment, our homes, our streets. If I'm going to call a cop every time I see a problem, guess what, Paul Peter? I'm setting the cops up to fail. And it might be that I could resolve it, and maybe I have a responsibility to do it first. And I have not heard anybody say that. I've heard people talk about we should knock on the window, but there is something thematic here that we automatically think we need to call a cop. When do we start thinking about what's my responsibility, Paul Peter?
I think what you're describing is being a good citizen. That's first and foremost. Secondly, do we even teach civics in schools anymore? Third, do we teach critical thinking skills? Now, when we talk about what our individual responsibility is, I think number one, respect and communicate. If you think of the incident that happened in Central Park, where a woman decided to call the cops on an African-American because he was bird watching. She didn't communicate, she didn't talk, she assumed the worst. And if anyone's ever been in a management position, there are always two sides to every story, so you communicate. You brought up defunding of the police department, and I wanna share a personal story. I don't think we're going to defund the police department. What we need to do is reallocate resources. And you touched on setting the police up for failure. I've been involved in prison work for many years now, and I participate in a pen pal program. I've done it for the last 10 years. And one of the gentlemen who wrote to me, once they get to know you, they trust you and they'll share things, shared with me that he was sexually abused by his mother. He ended up in foster care where he was abused again, ended up in another place where he was abused. And by the time he was in his early teens, he started to act out. And by the time he hit his late 20s, he was drunk and he murdered someone. He's not getting out of jail. And I thought to myself, and this happened in New York. This did not happen in Mississippi or Alabama. And New York has what I would describe as Cadillac social welfare benefits. Where was the state? Where was the community to intervene on behalf of this child who's being sexually abused, physically abused, emotionally abused? And then we as a society are shocked that this person begins to act out and do very bad things. Then, of course, we throw them into prison, and that's a whole different kettle of fish. We need prison reform as well. So what is our responsibility? Be good citizens, communicate, engage.
So Dave Leventhal, as I'm listening to him, I mean, that's part of the problem is that I think of all the male politicians that I've run against and all the men that I've known, and they always used to sort of marginalize me and go, oh, Arnie, she's so good on those soft issues. She's always talking about healthcare and education and the environment. And like, oh, come on, I'm good on the other issues. I'm good on the economy. I'm going to help open up business. I'm going to do this. And when you look at what is causing the failure now, Dave, what's causing the failure? You know, the lack of access to healthcare. So you have underlying conditions. So you're dying of COVID-19. The lack of environmental protection. So you've been breathing in lousy air. So your lungs are depleted and you're living in the worst polluted part of the world. What's happening is that we haven't educated people and stepped in. So those are the kinds of things, I think, Dave, that are really causing, I think, so many of the problems. Are we prepared to see those as priorities now and not back of the bus issues?
It's possible anything could happen. I would say, at least in the brief time I think we have left, is that, you know, we've really ingrained, especially since September 11th, and there's been a major change in the way that policing has worked in this country. I'll pick up this thought in just a second, but leave it there, Arnie.
All right. This is the Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's our Monday edition, the Rethink the Week edition. We have been talking with Dean Spiliotis, Paul Peter Jessup, and Dave Leventhal. We'll be right back.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. At the Indiana Dunes National Park, visitors hope to glimpse the Karner blue butterfly. At Yosemite, they look for the American pika. But these and other species are at risk as climate change hits national parks.
Human-caused climate change exposes the U.S. national parks more severely to heat and aridity than the country as a whole.
That's Patrick Gonzalez of the University of California, Berkeley. He says since 1895, temperature in the parks has increased at double the national rate.
The hotter and drier conditions in national parks occur because vast areas of the parks are located in extreme environments, the Arctic, high mountains, and the arid Southwest.
The rapid warming can destroy important habitat for plants and animals. But reducing carbon pollution can help. Gonzalez's research shows that swift action could reduce the expected heat increase in national parks by up to two-thirds.
The U.S. national parks protect some of the most irreplaceable natural areas and cultural sites in the world. Cutting carbon pollution would reduce human-caused climate change and help save our national parks for future generations.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother. I was raised here in this living hell. You don't know my kind in your world. Very soon, the time will tell. We'll
act perdu of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Artie Artisan and producer Ken Barnes. Joining us again is Dave Leventhal, Dean Spiliotis, and Paul Peter Jessup. Dave, you were just talking as we were ending this segment, and I just keep thinking about, you mentioned 9/11, and you know what always reminded me about 9/11? Remember when we wanted to talk about root causes? Remember that? Oh my God, you would have thought that we were like, you know, like the worst of the worst, and yet in a lot of ways, by not having confronted root causes back in 9/11, because that conversation was so marginalized, this is again a conversation, guess what, Dave, about root causes.
First of all, Arnie, I would have to say that I've lived in a variety of different cities, in Dallas, Texas, and New Hampshire, Buffalo, New York, Allentown, Pennsylvania, Washington, D.C. There are some police forces that are better than others, okay? And every city, every town, every village has a different police force. Some are highly functional, well-funded, and really serve the community well. Others are struggling mightily or may even be pretty bad. I've seen some that are straight out of the Dukes of Hazzard, and it's ugly. So I think that's important to note. Another thing too, just picking up at the point about the past 20 years is, here in Washington, D.C., and definitely around, you know, many, many metropolitan areas around the country, people have been conditioned over the past 15 to 20 years to expect that if something's going wrong, that the police can and should help them. See something, say something. That's a motto that you're going to see everywhere when you travel in the metro of Washington, D.C. and whatnot. So, you know, alongside that, too, you've had so many cities that, to the point about responsibility and taking individual responsibility, in a way, the responsibility has been taken over by the government, by the police department. The public has ceded that, I guess you could say, in some cases. We have traffic cameras. We have red light cameras. We have, in some cases, police cameras on every other corner. Everyone carries a cell phone. You can post stuff online, you can send it to the police, you can call the police at the touch of a button. Nobody could do that 25 or 30 years ago, okay? You know, nobody had the ability to have instant communication universally with the police department. So it really is kind of comparing two eras, and that's very difficult to do. So I think the bottom line at this point for governments at the local level, the state level, and here in DC at the federal level, is a question of what's going to change now? Where have we gone wrong? What have we done that has caused police forces across the country to provide a disservice in some cases to the populations that they're supposed to protect and serve? And how do we change that so that the police forces, the rules that govern police forces, are going to be more effective for not just a segment of the population, but the entire population?
Ken?
To some extent, actually, Dave, thanks for bringing up the 9/11 change in people's way of thinking, because the main change, I think, at that time was the police were given more power, the military was given more power, the government could spy on us. Everything was treated as a military kind of problem. But I think that even before 9/11, all of society was treating every problem with the same kind of Trump-esque kind of stick approach. You know, school, I was a public defender in 1991. I remember kids, young middle school kids, the first thing the school did if there was any kind of trouble at all was they'd call the police and the kid would be hauled off to juvie court and maybe detained in juvie jail. And we would say, well, how about a social worker? How about, you know, you deal with the human problem and the human issues, and maybe they're impoverished and maybe they're homeless. The homeless problem. I lived in New York when Mayor Koch was suggesting that all the homeless be rounded up and either locked up in jail, or his suggestion was to put them on a barge and have it circle Manhattan and get them off the streets and out of sight. Society has dealt with all these social problems with a non-social, non-economic, non-humane policy of let's just have the cops go out and drag them away.
Yeah, but Dean, I think what's happened in the last couple of months is that you know, the see something, say something, Dave, you know what I say before, and the idea of individual responsibility. Why didn't that Wendy's owner knock on the window? And I think here's the problem. I think the see something, say something has been more lethal for people of color than for white people. And that's the problem. The problem is it isn't generic. Nobody calls the see something, say something on Arnie, you know, but the see something becomes, it has almost become color coded.
Unless you're standing in the middle of the street, Arnie.
Unless you're standing in the middle of the street, exactly. but you see my point. My point is that is part of the problem. Is we make certain assumptions, and we've been hearing now black athletes and black actors, and I mean I love the story of Oprah going into some very, very, very highfalutin, you know, Tiffany's or whatever, asking to see like a piece of jewelry, and the woman didn't recognize her, and basically she called over the police within the Tiffany's to sort of check her out, and it was Oprah, and it was like, how could you not recognize me? Well, she's a woman of color. That's how she doesn't get recognized, because all people of color look the same, don't they? I mean, this is really what it's come down to, and it's this kind of disgusting underbelly of racism. And that requires so much rethinking and reevaluating and reteaching, Dean. Oh, my God.
Well, it's a really interesting point you raise, Arnie. I'm sure at the time that the whole concept of see something, say something was thought up and publicized, you know, it was seen as a way to get civic participation and to get people to be responsible for their own security. But as you suggested, it really has kind of tapped into pre-existing prejudices and has led to a kind of a new manifestation of those prejudices in ways that a lot of people probably didn't really give much thought to. But now we're seeing that seeing something and saying something is in a large part driven by how you see something and what you say.
Exactly. So Paul Peter, we got to talk about the U.S. military, because it's also been an incredibly interesting week. You know, he goes to West Point and he gives a boring speech. And I'm going to tell you something. The one thing that I haven't seen people go completely berserk about is I listened, unfortunately, to Donald Trump's speech at West Point. What's my problem? I need a life. Anyway, but I'm listening to this 30-minute speech and I'm almost falling asleep. But here's the part that made me the most angry about his speech. And that is what he said to them, those of you that had some kind of infraction, I am going to whitewash it and that infraction goes off your record. I almost went through the TV screen, because you know what? Actions are supposed to have consequences. Mistakes are supposed to be recognized. They're supposed to go on your record. You're supposed to be able to show that you have rehabilitated. What does Donald Trump do? And he actually got applause for that. And I haven't heard a lot of people talk about that, but that to me is the essence of Donald Trump. He thinks he's this God who can come in and say, what you see isn't what you really see. My lies are actually your truth for the moment. And if you've done something wrong and you happen to be someone that I want to sort of court, I'm going to make sure it disappears like Flynn. All right? But that to me was, I think, the essence of his speech to West Point. And yet it wasn't even discussed. And here's a man who uses the military as if it's a pawn for him, to the point where the military now is finally standing up and speaking out about not being used this way. But even in that speech in West Point, if I was in the military, I would have been appalled at that, because that's not how you teach your cadets. You teach your cadets because it's supposed to be a learning experience, not a whitewashing experience.
My first observation is another reason why I'm hopeful. We have military leaders who are coming forward and they're speaking out, and they're doing it in a very reserved, diplomatic manner. Bottom line, he is the commander in chief, and so they're caught between a rock and a hard place. I think there are many conversations that are being had behind the scenes that we won't know about until this man's out of office. And I'm confident that the military is doing the right thing behind the scenes. They're not going to say certain things in public because it's going to create chaos. So I'm hopeful. And is it surprising that he said what he said? It's not surprising. However, let me add something to this overall conversation. Ultimately, we, the citizens of this republic, have a responsibility to hold people accountable, period. How many times are we going to reelect mediocrity to Congress or state legislatures? I don't understand. And if you're going to whine about something, tell me, explain to me why you keep on sending the same people back.
Well, and Dave, as he said that, I mean, I know it sounds so trite, but to me, it's so thematic of his leadership style, of what's happening in America, that we don't own our mistakes. We don't recognize mistakes. We think those mistakes should be ignored. And give me one second. My daughter was 10 years old and she got caught cheating in elementary school. And the entire group of kids, there were about 8 of them, were basically sent in for suspension and had to go to school on a Saturday morning. She was angry at me because I made her go to suspension. She goes, oh, mom. I said, did you do something wrong? She wouldn't answer. I said, would you do it again? She didn't answer. I said, you're going to suspension on Saturday. Guess what? My kid was the only one that showed up for suspension. Every other parent got their kid out. And my daughter came home furious with me. And she said, you don't love me, mom. And I went, no, I do. I love you a lot. I want you to learn from this. I said, not going to suspension, you learn nothing. You made a mistake, now you have to own it. And so as I'm watching the president, that 10-year-old daughter comes roaring back in my head and those parents covering for their kids. And I'm going, what did they teach? And so I am looking at this moment in a lot of ways, and it's the history we don't know about African Americans. It's the whitewashing of history. It's what we don't know about Tulsa. It's all these things. Part of the problem is if you haven't been taught something, if you've whitewashed your past, how do you expect people to be able to understand with knowledge and be able to change, Dave?
You mentioned Donald Trump. In an electoral context, I think you're going to have a lot of people that everyone in the nation is going to have to watch very closely to see if the people of Pennsylvania and Michigan and Florida and even a state like Texas are searching their souls, their own souls, in a way to answer the question of whether they believe Donald Trump has made, in their estimation, too many mistakes that have affected them, and that they're not going to give Donald Trump a free pass. They're not going to give Donald Trump a second chance or, of course, a second term. And the reason I mentioned Texas is because if you look at the poll numbers, and yes, you can easily dismiss poll numbers, they are snapshots in time. What is the truth today will not be the truth in 2 weeks, but it's showing that Joe Biden and Donald Trump are tied. So you really can't ignore that. And hands down, if Joe Biden wins Texas, game over. Joe Biden's the president of the United States. So this is a drama that's not playing out just nationwide. This is a drama that will be playing out with the most grave of implications in many of the 50 states that are going to have a direct bearing on whether Donald Trump is president or not, whether Congress is controlled by one party or the other, or divided for that matter. And you don't want to politicize everything, but the election is in November. It's coming up. It's here. The conventions, in whatever form or fashion they take, they're happening next month and the month after. So stuff's getting real, and it's getting real in the midst of a pandemic, in the midst of a nationwide conversation of a sort that we haven't had in a long, long time about race, about equality, or should I better say inequality. And we're going to have an opportunity to, in a major way, not just have a litmus test, but truly have the test to determine which direction this country is going in based on all of these incredible, insane flashpoints that are happening. Insane because they're all happening at once. They're all happening right at the same time.
So Dean, I just got a note in the mail this morning. Joni Ernst in Iowa is in trouble. Joni Ernst in Iowa is in trouble. Now, Iowa used to be kind of like a purple state, a bellwether. It would swing back and forth and back and forth, but it's been getting pretty Republican in the last couple of years. That Joni Ernst is in trouble is really kind of, I think, somewhat shocking, because I think she's tried to sort of thread the needle, not be completely a Trumpist, but at the same time, you know, exercise some discretion. And the fact that she's in trouble, and what Dave just said about Texas is absolutely true, Dave. People are actually talking about a Democratic Speaker of the House in Texas. I mean, that hasn't been seen in years. So I do think that this moment has potential for real change, even beyond just Joe Biden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I've seen a number of analyses of the Joni Ernst race. I think she's down by 3 points, which, you know, is essentially a tied race. But right. Nonetheless, I've seen a number of analysts refer to it as the canary in the coal mine for Republicans. If she's in trouble, then that's going to have repercussions you can only imagine for people like Martha McSally in Arizona and Susan Collins in Maine and Cory Gardner and Colorado. So, yeah, I mean, it just speaks to the unsettled nature of the electorate. It's all going to come down to turnout and the ability for people to have a genuine opportunity to vote. But there certainly are plenty of signs that suggest that if everything breaks in one direction, as someone mentioned earlier, that, you know, we could end up with a very different looking world than we have right now. I mean, I almost akin to going from 2002, the midterm in which George Bush gained seats, one of the rare times that presidents gain seats at the midterm, to 2008, where, you know, Democrats had already taken over in Congress and Barack Obama won the presidency.
Paul Peter, talk to me about Joe Biden. I know right now the big conversation is, obviously, he responded to the George Floyd murder. He spoke at the funeral. He's a man that does empathy probably better than anyone else, having had so much loss in his life. So he's got the language of empathy down, something that I think a lot of people need. But this is a time now, given what's going on in the streets, where empathy only takes you so far. And now people are wondering what kind of change is going to happen. So there's a lot of talk about his VP pick. And everyone is saying that this is actually going to be crucial because it's going to be kind of like the signage for the campaign. Also someone who could also speak to the moment. So I guess as you're looking at this VP pick, people keep saying, it doesn't have any meaning. I'm not so sure that's playing out. I think VP pick this time is going to have a tremendous amount of meaning, in part because Joe Biden has been around for so long, and he's not exactly the most inspiring candidate.
Yeah, I think for one of the first times in recent history, the VP will be so important. In November, Joe Biden turns 78.
Oh, God. All right, sorry.
So he can't even finish out his first term without hitting 80. He would be 82 or 81 in seeking re-election. And I have no doubt that this is going to be a campaign issue. So his vice presidential candidate is going to be so important for so many reasons. And in looking at the list that he's narrowed down, in my view, I think his best bet is Susan Rice. Don't know, but I think that would be the best bet. He's been presidential, he's been empathetic, and I'm not sure if people are ready to hear about solutions. I think this has to be a process. They need to know that someone cares, that someone is feeling for them, someone is genuine, someone is sincere. The policy platform can roll out.
So Dave, you're in Washington. So what's the scuttlebutt? I mean, who's on first, who's on second, who's on third, whatever the story is. I'm kind of curious as to what you're hearing, because I actually was hearing the mayor of Atlanta. I think the situation going on right now has made it very hard for the mayor of Atlanta. She got a lot on her plate, okay? So again, oh my God, timing is everything in this business. But I do think we were talking about how diverse these protests have been, young people, old people, people of color, white people, Hispanic people. I do think, therefore, that a woman of color probably makes sense at the moment, given the fact that these protests have been so diverse. The idea of having that experience in the White House, especially women who, you know, I go back to Shirley Chisholm and Barbara Jordan and all those remarkable Black women that have inspired so many of us. I do think that not only is it the moment for a woman of color, but that is a person who could actually maybe have a conversation that Joe is not necessarily good at delivering.
Yeah, I would be surprised if Joe Biden didn't pick a woman of color. And it could be any of probably, you know, 8 or 10 different candidates who are being considered. Susan Rice here in D.C., her stock is on the rise. I would say that Keisha Lance Bottoms, the mayor of Atlanta, her stock is, you know, definitely going down. Kamala Harris is always going to be in the mix. And look, when we talk about vice presidents, we usually in the moment overinflate their importance. I mean, Arnie, if you polled 100 people in New Hampshire who are even fairly politically savvy about who Hillary Clinton's vice presidential nominee was in 2016, I bet a lot of them aren't going to pull Tim Kaine out of the hat, okay?
But this was a bad choice anyway. That, by definition, you forgot him as soon as she nominated him.
Most of the time, you're not going to think John Edwards or Dan Quayle or even remember who nominated whom, but this I agree. This is a very different situation, and just by the fact that Joe Biden has said, I am going to nominate a woman, there's going to be a lot of interest and intrigue that all the vice presidential veep stakes choices have lacked. in the past, and given the moment of time, given Joe Biden's age, given the fact that he may not be interested even in serving a second term if it got to that point, the vice presidential nominee being the proverbial heartbeat away from the presidency is going to be incredibly, incredibly key.
Dave, how can people keep saying that Kamala Harris has a good shot and she's always going to be in the picture? Doesn't she have the same problem that Klobuchar has, that she was very bad on reforming police systems and mass incarceration? People were very disappointed with her when she was prosecutor.
Absolutely. And also, too, all you have to go back is to some of the early debates and some of the things that she was saying about Joe Biden and race at that point, which you can better believe the Trump campaign is going to pull out, and every super PAC that's supporting Trump is going to pull out and remind people of in spades. So although a lot of people peg her, you know, kind of choice one, two or three for Joe Biden, I'm not sure. And she's well known. She's a known commodity. She's a senator and not a, you know, a mayor or a U.S. House representative like Val Demings, for example.
So Dee, I want to end with Val Demings, because I think Val Demings threads so many needles for him. Florida police chief. She's well spoken. She doesn't have any of that good tape that Kamala has that, you know, that Trump people can use on her. She sort of worked herself up the ladder. She's well-spoken. She could speak to the moment having been a police chief. And we had Bill Curry on this week, and Bill Curry says, yeah, she's more moderate than most people, but you know, she's the moderate I could like, and this is a very progressive Democrat. So I do think that, again, this is such an interesting time, and I think a VP pick could energize a campaign that right now doesn't have much energy, except it's not Trump.
Joe Biden to be convinced that she can be the president of the United States.
And what do you think?
Yeah, I think, you know, in the end, it comes down to ultimately who the vice president is most comfortable with. It'll come down to whether or not they see anything problematic in the vetting. I'm sort of in the middle. I won't say that the VP pick is unimportant, but I do think we tend to overanalyze it and put a little bit too much weight in it. It certainly can provide a short-term boost to a ticket. You know, I mean, there are a number of possibilities that we've discussed. I will say, if it's Susan Rice, get ready to spend the next 3 months talking about Benghazi. It's going to be be Hillary Clinton and Benghazi.
No, please, God.
It's going to be Benghazi day in and day out if it's Susan Rice.
Oh, if you see, again, Val Demings. We've got none of that problem. Val Demings, I'm putting my money on it. All right, just letting you know, that's where my money's going.
So, Dean, that word Benghazi was really scary. How is that going to play out? Does Rice have a positive defense that could work?
It's been litigated over and over again. And I think that, you know, certain Republicans would certainly look favorably on the opportunity to bring that all up again. You know, I mean, we can debate about whether or not she handled it well and whether or not her explanation of everything was sufficient. But I think that's the big issue with her. She's a foreign policy portfolio that overlaps with Joe Biden. I mean, Biden has a long background in foreign policy, so that may not be as useful in terms
added value.
You know, she's never run for elective office before. Now, that didn't stop Donald Trump, but she's not the most kind of campaigny sort of person out there. She's a policy intellectual and an administrator. So the question would be sort of how would she be in a political context? I don't know the answer to that, but that's just another question. But I agree with Arne. Val Demings, you can tell when you see her on TV now, she realizes that the spotlight is on her,
right,
and this is really her opportunity. Yeah. You can tell that she knows that she has moved way up on the possibility list for a whole host of reasons.
And I think what Dean said, Dave, is really important. I mean, she does bring added value. And I don't just mean because she's a woman of color. I mean, it's her experience, it's her geography, it's her history.
Florida,
well, of course, that's the geography piece. But I mean, And the other problem, I think, with Susan Rice, no offense, Paul Peter, but Barack Obama was a new Democrat. Barack Obama brought in Rahm Emanuel. Barack Obama brought in Larry Summers. Barack Obama brought in, I mean, there's this little sort of elite cabal around Barack Obama that was very friendly to corporate America. I want that gone. And as Bill Curry said, you get the sense with Val Demings, she owes nobody. She doesn't know, no corporation's going to call her up and say, oh, Val, it's been so long. Or she didn't go to any of those like Harvard graduation or Harvard, whatever. And I think there's this sort of delightful moat around her that makes her very, very trustworthy at a time where we're kind of looking at both the corporate involvement in the next administration, as well as having a conversation with America at a time when we're worried about things like the protests and Black Lives Matter and defund the police. I think she speaks with some level of integrity. So anyway, that's my pitch. There's so much happening. I have to go back to what you said, Paul Peter. You're hopeful. It's the only way I can survive. I have to be hopeful too, because I feel like everyone is sort of waking up at the same moment, and that's a good thing. Now, if we can take that waking up and translate it into exercising the franchise, it'll make a difference. Having said that, I need to thank all of you for joining us. Thank you so much. Joining us, Dave Leventhal, Dean Spiliotis, Paul Peter Jessup, and of course, my producer, Ken Barnes. Good luck with the new job, Dave.
Take care, folks.
Thank you. Have a good week.
Okay. We'll see you again. All right, have a good one. Bye, folks.
This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. We will schmooze tomorrow. Ciao.
Hey, what's happening?
Brother, what's up?
This is a groovy party, man.
Yeah,
I can dig it.
Stop it. Right on.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love. Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
You know we've got to find a way.
Signs. Don't punish me,
sister,
with brutality,
sister.
Talk to me,
sister,
so you can see,
sister.
Oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on?
Yeah, what's going on?
What's going on?
Oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
Right now, right now.
Sounds.